and you can't even drive.
Oh, look, we're live, but the thing didn't play.
Oh.
And you can't even drive. I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today, isn't it?
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to the deepest lore of a Monday with myself, Panama Hat, and my good friend, Mr. John D.
Hello, Mr. Hat.
Hello there. We're here again to talk about T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, picking up where we left off, and we must get it finished this week. We must finish our analysis and discussion of this seminal work of English poetry.
Indeed. We've started a bit late today because academic agent was detained with other matters. Both foreign and domestic, but he will not be joining us. So it's just going to be Mr. Hat and myself, which is probably for the best. So last week we did a very short explanation of Eliot, and then we did a reading of The Wasteland. And I would very strongly suggest that if you haven't seen last week's installment, that you should watch it before you watch this installment.
Yes.
Because it's you need to hear the reading and you need to sort of get up to speed on, because we've talked about the first two sections of the poem. Obviously you can certainly watch the stream now, but definitely go back and watch part one. Mm-hmm. To really get the full picture. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, definitely. Go back, have all our introductory notes to Eliot and us reading the entire poem, basically, before we get on. And of course, because you have to do it in order, you can't just jump about with this. You know, this isn't the four quartets. You know, where it's sort of four different elements, if you will. This is a piece that is meant to be. It's been thematically arranged to have a certain effect. So you do really need to start from the beginning with this one. The poem's disappeared off the screen. I don't have any control over that.
There's a lot of great information and history in this book, and even a mystery trick that you can learn at the end. So take it from me, Kenneth Michael Benbow Blake. This is a great book to read, so pick it up at your local library now.
I can't believe he would interrupt T.S. Eliot to shill some tatty old book about politics or society.
Yeah, I mean, we're literally like two of the most popular draws on this channel. You know, without us, Hat, this show would be in deep trouble, I would say.
It would be. You know, shall we tell people? Should we disencourage them from sending super chats?
Yeah, I hope you people understand. When you send super chats, we're not getting any of these super chats.
No.
These are going to this greedy little man, this Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna, the Persian merchant. And we're getting none of this. So, you know, don't send super chats.
Yeah. Because it doesn't matter that Mr. D and I will stay up all night rehearsing and planning our analysis and coordinating. No, it doesn't matter. We're not going to see a penny. We don't see anything. Yeah. So anyway.
I am forced to remind you that you should also check out Academic Agent on Cotto Gottfried.
Oh, you're not going to do the show.
Later tonight.
Yeah.
I am being Cotto forced. being forced to remind you of that too. Well, we'll dip into that again later on. Anyway. So we're up to section three of the Wasteland. I mean, the Wasteland is as we saw from the reading last week, divided into five sections, each of them very different, and each of them quite full of a lot of very dense material. I would say that, you know, certainly part three and part five are probably the most dense with references and allusions to things. So, so the fire sermon.
Yes, the fire sermon, just to bring everyone up to speed, obviously the third section. Now, this is where we really begin to get into the Buddhist-inspired parts of the Wasteland. Eliot drew, and would continue to draw throughout his career, very heavily on Eastern religions, Eastern philosophies, and kind of motifs. And I believe you, Mr. D, you have your copy of the Upanishads with you.
Yeah, I would say we should save that until, because it that doesn't really come up until the final section. I would say you're right in that the fire sermon does. So the title of this section itself, Fire Sermon, relates to a sermon by the Buddha called the Fire Sermon, and I have some notes here. I just want to pull them up. So, yes, I mean, as we said with the last week with the Wasteland, it's a sort of I would say an amalgamation, a sort of a gathering of fragments, and you know, both quite literally and also figuratively, and in a way, you know, sort of, I mean, I think Eliot was trying to, with the form of the poem, to evoke this sense of the modern world as basically a collection of fragments, a field of ruins of a once great edifice. And so of course there's bits and pieces from everywhere. Now, significantly, Eliot is known for being quite a devout Christian, but I believe the Wasteland was written before his conversion to Anglicanism. I mean, he'd come from an American Unitarian family, but he didn't convert to the Anglican faith, and I don't think he didn't really have a very, very strong connection to Christianity until at least 1927, which was somewhat after the Wasteland.
He was beginning to head that way, certainly. And by this time, he was already very kind of, you know, I suppose what you might call a kind of secular Christian. Like he was already very reactionary. Obviously, you know, this poem is all about the modern world and how horrible it is. And, you know, very kind of, he was a kind of what you'd call a secular Christian, I suppose.
Yes. I'm still flipping through my notes. So if you want to, you have anything else to, say about this, before we start, whilst I find the.
No, I think we can sort of jump in. Obviously, the main theme in this section, or I should say, the main image, what it kind of follows, is the River Thames. Everything seems to be based around the River Thames, and there's references to London, and as a lot of the Wasteland is.
Yes, and so what we're getting also at the beginning of this is he's setting up a kind of dual mythology. So another one of the great sources for, you know, a sort of inspiration for the Wasteland is Norse mythology and Germanic mythology, and then by extension, kind of a European mythos as conducted through the figure of Richard Wagner. We mentioned last week that, you know, Wagner's sort of use of the Eddas, which are these, you know, sort of Icelandic epics, which are the kind of origin of most Norse mythology, were sort of a very important revival of interest in this source of European civilization in the 19th century. And it was an extraordinarily influential kind of revival. You know, as I said, J.R.R. Tolkien drew very heavily upon the Eddas and upon Wagner's interpretation of these works for, you know, the Lord of the Ring and other of Tolkien's mythologies. So, and indeed, Eliot as well is alluding heavily to characters specifically from Wagner, but again using Wagner as a conduit for more ancient tales. But again, it's very much in the spirit of the fragmentary modernism of the wasteland to sort of need a kind of modern or quasi-modern conduit to connect to an old tradition. I mean, you know, even this sort of foundational mythos of Europe, or certainly of Scandinavia and Germanic peoples, can only be sort of reached by Eliot, can only be reached through a kind of reference, you know, through Wagnerian opera, through this sort of yesterday's source. So I think even by referencing the works that he did, that there's a sense again of this kind of brokenness of a line of tradition.
Yes, it ties into the grand idea of the poem that, you know, everything has come crashing down. The blanket has been lifted up, and it turns out that basically the Western civilization is done for, and we only have these fragments and bits and pieces, which is what's been reflected here. So, shall we jump in to the fire sermon?
Yes. So of course, the first section we almost get a kind of he's setting us up to think of this bit as a lament. So of course we bet the river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. So, you know, again, this is being set up as almost a kind of lament or a song of sorrow.
That's Sweet Thames, run softly. I think you will know it, Mr. D, because it's from one of your favorite poets, actually. It's an Edmund Spenser.
Yes, line. It's a bit from an Edmund Spenser poem called the Prothamalion, I believe.
That's right. Yes, Prothamalion.
Yeah,
which is a wedding, a poem traditionally written for a wedding, the Prothamalion.
Okay, I just thought I'd read just the first couple of stanzas of the Prothamalion, if you don't mind. Calm was the day, and through the trembling air, sweet breathing Zephyrus did softly play a gentle spirit that lightly did delay hot Titan's beams, which then did glister fair, when I, whom sullen care, through discontent of my long fruitless stay in prince's court, and expectation vain of idle hopes, which still do fly away like empty shadows, did afflict my brain, walked forth to ease my pain along the shore of silver streaming Thames, whose rutty bank, which his river hems, was painted all with variable flowers, and all the meads adorned with dainty gems fit to deck maidens' bowers, and crown their paramours against the bridal day, which is not long. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. There in a meadow by the river's side, a flock of nymphs I chanced to espy, all lovely daughters of the flood thereby, with goodly greenish locks all loose untied. And goes on and on. But again, you can see that Eliot is directly quoting this poem, but also, again, taking the setting here, which, of course, is this you know, the poem begins with someone strolling the banks of the Thames. But, of course, the Thames, of course, in Spenser's, the Thames is painted with variable flowers and all the meads adorned with dainty gems and the maidens preparing for a wedding, whereas in the wasteland, it's a very different picture. It's the brown land, unheard. The nymphs are departed, no longer there. Sinking into the pond, you know? Yes, in the next few lines, the river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchief, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights, the nymphs are departed. And again, rather than this sort of preparation for a wedding feast, you get the detritus of kind of broken and profaned modernism. You know, this is the banks of a ruined Thames.
Mm-hmm. All this junk. And of course, notice how the rhythm grinds, what slams to a halt there. Other testimony of summer nights, full stop. The nymphs are departed, full stop. That's all in one line, of course. So it's like he's slamming on the brakes then, you know, because, you know, there is nothing. The Thames is empty. The land is brown. Nymphs are gone. There's nothing to talk about. And then he picks it up again. And their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors departed, have left no addresses.
Mm.
So again, another reference to the kind of merchant caste to which we're also to which we're also scornful, including Eliot. You know, the loitering heirs of city directors. It's sort of, you know, rich kids of people that work in the financial part of the city directors, and they've left no addresses. Now, of course, this is basically a reference to, because it's talking about the nymphs, the fact that young sons of kind of rich men would obviously go and have a good time on the town with any girls they could find, but they wouldn't leave an address or a name so that you wouldn't be able to contact them again the following morning. It's a deliberate reference to that culture, if you will. The idea that they're not just doing it with sort of like low class girls in the town, they're doing it with the nymphs, the nymphs of the water, you know.
Yes. Mm. And then we get this line: "By the waters of Leman, I sat down and wept." This always struck me as quite curious. I mean, so Leman is a lake in Switzerland. Yeah. It's Geneva Lake is on Leman. Lake Leman, Lac Leman, and Lausanne is on this lake as well. I've always taken this little aside as a reference to Eliot's autobiography himself, because as far as I understand, he had actually gone to Switzerland as a part of a kind of retreat to deal with his psychological distress at this time. Yeah, I mean, we have a reference elsewhere in the poem to Margit, where he also went again to sort of to recuperate, and so I take it as that. I don't know how about you.
Yes, I agree. Some parts of the poem are quite obviously autobiographical. And yes, he literally was there when he wrote a large part of this poem before he handed it to Ezra Pound. And then, of course, we return to "Sweet Thames Run Softly," and then we get "Sweet Thames Run Softly, for I speak not loud or long." Basically, so you know, it's a kind of the theme in this short section here is just this idea that things are coming to a halt, things are stopping. You know, he doesn't have much to say. Things are all kind of anything he could discuss is gone. So he speaks not loud or long, but at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. according to the annotated edition, it's a reference to Andrew Marvell, actually, who the viewers of this channel will know. It says it's a reference to his coy mistress. And Elliot made a note. According to this edition, in Marvell's poem, written in the 1600s, the narrator entreats a woman he desires to set aside her modesty and sleep with him. The line Elliot alludes to occurs at a transition in the poem. The narrator begins by telling the woman how he would praise her if he had eternity to do so. Because time is short, however, her coyness is a terrible waste, and they should put their youthful bodies to use before they wither and die. Because so that but at my back I always hear is directly from Marvell.
Right.
Right. So and then we get this wonderful bit of a rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank. While I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening, round behind the gas house, musing upon the king my brother's wreck, and on the king my father's death before him. Which is this kind of wonderful blending of obviously the sort of rotten Thames side things like the rats and the gas house, mixed with what are quite obvious quotes from The Tempest. And of course, kind of duly alluding to the Fisher King, which is a common theme that we've talked about throughout the poem. It comes up a lot. The idea of the Fisher King, who just a refresher, if you missed that last week, is a king. The legend of a king who is injured in his loin, you know, and so he's in some way impotent. He's alive, but he's impotent, and because he is impotent and kind of barren, his land, his kingdom, also is that way. Nothing.
Yes.
That's it.
His lands must suffer the same curse as he. The Fisher King, of course, it can be healed. There is the possibility of healing and redemption, and thus healing redemption of the land. And he would be healed by a certain question asked by basically a chosen one. In the case of the Fisher King, very specifically, the chosen one is Percival, the Arthurian, you know, knight of the Round Table. And Elliot refers many times to different versions of Parsifal, which is, you know, again, the telling of this story of Percival's. And eventually Percival does heal the Fisher King. And by doing so, he actually becomes the Keeper of the Grail. He heals the land, but the Fisher King dies as a result of it, and Percival heals the land. And there's a reference to that at the end of this, of this stanza. That bit of French is from Paul Valin, et de ses voix d'enfant chantant dans la cupola. That is a line from the end of Valin's Parsifal. And this whole section, again, he's intermingling legend and kind of modern reality. So again, while I was fishing in the dull canal, and keep in mind that when the Fisher King was wounded, you know, when he was struck in the genitals, he was also unable. He also became crippled. He couldn't walk, and so all he could do was sit in a small boat and desperately fish in the barren waters outside his castle. So this is what Elliot is, you know, directly referring to. While I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening round behind the gas house, and again, pulling, you know, taking this sort of legendary mythos and sort of intermingling it with these very stark images of modern London, you know, behind the gas house. And then we get this very high language. I mean, someone who's fishing in a canal, a dull canal, behind the gas house, isn't usually the type of person who then muses upon the king my brother's wreck, and on the king my father's death before him. So it is this strange kind of fugue state between, you know, this sort of legendary king and the legendary mythos, and the sort of broken, corrupted, you know, modern state of the world. And I do like to think of lots of bits of the Wasteland as this kind of fugue state, as a sort of, again, like the character of Tiresias, who we mentioned last week. You know, it is a prophet, it is a seer who is sort of has a foot in both worlds, a foot in the world of the present, and a foot in the world in the other world. So many characters in the Wasteland, they're both kind of rooted in kind of myth, legend, or religion, but they're also then bound to the kind of corrupt and broken, sort of ultimate culmination or sort of ultimate end of the world they once inhabited. So they're once in the past and at once in the present.
Yes, indeed, and this part is extremely heavily close to a short section of The Tempest, in which Ferdinand says, "Where should this music be, in the air or the earth? It sounds no more, and sure, it waits upon some god of the island, sitting on a bank, weeping again, the king my father's wreck. This music crept by me upon the waters, allaying both their fury and my passion with its sweet air. Thence I have followed it, or it hath drawn me rather, but 'tis gone. No, begins again."
I'm sort of calling up this idea of both kind of degeneration and the possibility of regeneration. And water is a very strong theme in this entire poem. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't call it a pun, but, you know, water flows through the whole poem. I mean, this idea of water as a kind of the stream of time or the stream of history, or also the transformative, you know, thing that can wake up the stir the dull roots with spring rain. I mean, the first image we get in the poem is, of course, water, soaking into the earth, stirring the dormant roots and bringing forth flowers, and so we're given these sort of allusions to water throughout the entire poem, and the ability of water to both destroy things and to drown people, but also to bring renewal and regeneration. You know, the Thames may be sort of filthy and its banks covered, but it also eventually can flow clear and clean again. And I think that's a theme that we'll pick up. And then we get this strange, we're yanked back into modernity, the sound of horns and motors. Yes. And then we get Sweeney and Mrs. Porter.
Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring, and Eliot reads it as, "Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in soda water." Which, according to him, was a tune that he heard in, I think it was Melbourne in Australia. I have the exact note he made here. It says, "I do not know the origin of the ballad from which these lines are taken. It was reported to me from Sydney, Australia." So there you go. Just a sort of a bit of bad. I mean, it's not just Lord Byron. I'd have to look into that.
Yeah, I mean, Ace mentioned this, but I don't know that reference. So, it's just too bad he's not here to tell us about it.
So it's a line from Byron. "Let us have wine and women, mirth and laughter, sermons and soda water the day after."
Hmm.
Okay, I see. Wash their feet in soda water. Right, okay. And then we get is it Verlaine, you said?
Yeah, Paul Verlaine. Yes.
Which is, "And oh, those children's voices singing in the cupola."
Yes.
Which is another, apparently, according to the annotated edition, another reference to the Fisher King. Because it's a ref, it's from the Villain's version of Parsifal. From the end of the poem.
Indeed. Indeed. Mm-hmm.
Right, and then we get another call to the bird song. We get the twit 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 jug 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 so rudely forced terror, which is
it's
the callback to is it not Tiresias? What was his name? The we talked about it.
Tiroias and his Tiroias. His rape of Philomel or Philomela.
That's it. Yes. Yes, and of course they all get turned into birds at the end. So rudely forced, I believe.
So rudely forced, basically referring to her rape and murder, you know.
Yes.
And then literally calling his name Tiroias.
Yes. And then we move on to probably the most directly anti-bourgeois part of the poem, this next verse, and this actually was where it's quite a famous line now that was cut from the poem by Ezra Pound. Quite ironically, given Ezra Pound's feelings about this particular ethnicity of people, but basically the original poem had a lot more references to Jews and money. And there was a line in the poem which went something like disease in a dead Jew's eye, I think, was one of the lines. Graves' disease in a dead Jew's eye, among other things. And a lot of that got cut. So instead we have what remains. If you just scroll down slightly there, we got the unreal city under the brown fog of a winter noon. Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. We discussed this quite a lot when we did our original analysis of it last week before the stream, and we picked this apart a lot. So we've got the brown fog of a winter noon, and in London around this time, indeed, fog would have been brown. I think
the famous fogs. Yeah, the famous
We would have been brown because of all the industrial waste. So it's unreal. There's this blanket of basically unnatural fog which has been tinted by industrial waste. So first of all, there's this idea that the industry has dirtied everything.
This was still happening in my lifetime. I mean, I don't remember them, but I mean the fogs went on into the 70s. And if people are curious, you can look up images of these great great fogs, which killed people. I mean, you understand some of these fogs, when these fogs would happen, and they were, it wasn't just fog; it was a combination of kind of atmospheric fog, and as Mr. Hat said, all of these sort of pollutants from the coal smoke and industrial sort of effluent and all of these things, and they were quite dangerous. If you look at pictures of the fogs, it does render London into this sort of otherworldly, you know, sort of creepy looking thing. I mean, you know,
like 10 feet ahead. It was that bad. They used to call it the P super.
The P super.
And yes, I believe the last great smog was sometime in the 70s. The last sort of major one where people would have died. But yes, it was a continuous issue in London and other sort of major industry towns.
Yes, and if you go to places like Beijing or Cairo today, you can still see them.
Yes. Well, in fact, I mean, if you get, there's a thing they call the commuter cough, which still exists now. I mean, I had this the other day. About 2 days prior, I traveled to London. Well, of course, I'm usually here in the clean air of South Wales, and I traveled to London the day, and then the next morning home again, I was like coughing up phlegm for like 2 hours, just because, you know, all the car smoke and bus smog and you know, this it still happens, you know, still sort of happens. You just can't see it.
Yeah, well, I was telling Hat, the worst place I have ever been for this was Cairo. If you're in Cairo for about 24 hours, it's been years since I've been there, so I don't know. It's like you come down with bronchitis or something. It's absolutely horrible. Your voice is completely wrecked. You're coughing up, you know, sort of horrible things. You know, it's very difficult to breathe because, you know, Cairo is sort of in a kind of a place. It's unfortunately situated for the amount of kind of pollutants that it's getting, and they don't ever sort of get out.
Scroll up a bit, AA. We just haven't finished with that verse yet.
Eugenides.
Mr. Eugenides. Now, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, is, in my opinion, he's actually meant to be Greek, because you've got the name Eugenides, and then it mentions Smyrna, and at this time, during when the poem was being written, or perhaps slightly before, there was, of course, a war going on between the Greeks and the Turks after World War One, because Greece claimed large areas of land in Asia Minor, in Anatolia, including Smyrna, which was, you know, very ethnically Greek, as were large other areas of the coast. I think they also claimed Constantinople as well. It's this thing called the Megali idea, the idea that Greece has kind of these claims to territory in Asia Minor as well as in Europe. So there was a war over it, and the Greeks were advancing into Anatolia. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the Greeks lost. They were finally driven out by the Turks and pushed out of Asia Minor. And Smyrna was actually burned. The old ancient city of Smyrna was completely razed to the ground by an enormous fire. And I think there was then a population accord between the Greeks and the Turks. So all the Greeks in Turkey, all like sort of 2 or 3 million of them had to leave, and all the Turks and Greeks, and again, you know, 2 or 3 million of them had to leave and go to Turkey. This reference to Smyrna. So basically, the idea is that Mr. Eugenides is traveling. He's going around the place. He's arrived in London.
By the way, keep in mind Smyrna, which is now called the city of Izmir in Turkey, is still a very important port city. The events that Mr. Hat was talking about, I think happened in, it was, I think the changeover was in like 1930.
Was it later on?
Yeah, I think it became Izmir in 1930. So it was. But you know, certainly within the, you know, the echoes of this, of the composition of this poem. So anyway.
Yes. And then so we got, obviously he's unshaven, so he has this, you know, stubble. And anyone who's ever seen like a sort of trader, sort of middle class type from that part of the world knows what Elliot's talking about. You know, the prickly hair and the stubble all over the cheeks. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, Mr. D. With these sorts of characters, with a pocket full of currants. Now I'm going to have to refer to my notes again because this is quite significant. The currants. Elliot notes that the currants were quoted at a price, carriage and insurance fee to London, and the bill of lading, etc., were to be handed to the buyer upon payment of the site draft. So, carriage and insurance CIF. So basically, this is an old trading law. It's not talking about literal currents, I don't think, as in, you know, currents that you'd have in a scone or whatever. It's to do with basically trading and money.
He's trading currents. He's an importer of currents from, again, that part of the world. When you talk about current, like the dried things that you have in scones, those are not red currants. Those are not dried, like sort of the current fruit. They're actually sort of raisins. They're small raisins called currants. The etymology of that is unclear. It may actually come from the word Corinth.
Yes.
But yes, Han is right. I mean, he's talking about his role as a kind of a merchant, as an importer into London, and that this would be, you know, certainly at that time, London was a major kind of international port for imports, yes, and certainly to Britain.
And the paperwork has to be handed over at once. So again, it's all this imagery to do with trading and money and paperwork and all this sort of thing. And then he asked me in demotic French. Now, I think this is actually a very clever subtlety here, because Eliot says demotic French, and that sounds very learned, doesn't it? The idea of, you know, demotic French, as if it's a kind of higher form. But of course, all that means is common French. It means the French that's spoken every day. Like, it's just French. It's not anything special. It sounds better than it is, you know, demotic French. Because of course the whole idea is that this is a merchant, you know, he's got money, but he's not cultured, you know. He hasn't had a shave before he arrives. He's talking just in everyday French. You know, he doesn't sound anything more than what he is. And to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. So, you know, again, I believe the Metropole Hotel is still there, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, the Cannons, I believe there's still a hotel on Cannon Street, but I don't know about the Metropole.
Right.
Probably in some form, these remain.
According to the notes, it's still there. The Cannon Street Hotel is apparently still there, a hotel in central London.
Shall we charge on?
Yeah, so there's your verse about the thievering merchant middle classes swanning around the place. I mean, again, don't take these fragments in independently. So imagine the brown land with the river, with everything that's just piled into it. Everything's dying, the nymphs have gone. But there's still this, like, random foreign merchant, like, swanning around, you know, doing his business. I mean, this will be quite a common sight for anybody that's actually been to London in recent times. You know that it really does feel like this, you know. There seems to be nothing except foreign merchants making money. Anyway, so we got the next section, which after a bit... So this is the section we talked about of the typist, the young woman. This is a very prominent part of the poem.
In the first line there, we get the evocation of the violet hour, and this is something that is really associated with Eliot. That term comes up in elsewhere in the poem as well, the violet hour. And Eliot is refers to it both in the morning and in the evening. So basically, this is this moment, and everyone has seen it, this moment where, you know, if the weather is right, at either dawn or dusk, there is a period of, you know, 20, 30 minutes where the kind of the air takes on this violet hue. It is this point in the transition of the sun, either at dawn or dusk, where, you know, you get this very kind of bluish violet light that sort of bathes everything. And it makes everything look very strange. And sort of Eliot is calling up and sort of calling up that image to refer to a kind of transitional period. You know, this moment of magic, this moment when the world is transfigured into this strange, in this strange moment from which it emerges quite quickly. So, and of course, when he talks about the Violet Hour, it is always also referring to a kind of transitional moment. And here, the Violet Hour is literally the end of the workday, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting. And so again, this moment of transition, but it's also, I think, a moment of transition from the poem. You know, we've gotten this sort of evocation of the Thames, both past and present. We've gotten this sort of evocation of this tale of rape, this tale of classical tale of rape and murder and transformation. You know, the transformation of the victims of that into birds. That the you know, then we get this, you know, this little bit about Mr. Eugenides. And so now we get this entire scene. And I think it's very important that he's, again, brought up that evocation of Tereus and Philomela right before this bit.
Yes. And of course, this is all about sex and kind of a very low form of sex. And of course, so immediately you get the reference to the taxi throbbing, waiting, which becomes more sinister as this goes on. So the human engine, yes. The old man, of course, the reference to the prophet, the seer Tiresias, who can see all of this, he knows everything. And he is, of course, you know, as we mentioned last week, a prominent theme of the poem is the idea that you can't tell the difference between the men and the women anymore. The idea that the men are becoming like women and women are becoming like men. So hence, you know,
I don't get it. I mean, that's not, so what I get from it is more the kind of mystical interpretation of, again, Tiresias, a seer as this character with a kind of foot in both worlds, you know. Right. And as I think I mentioned last week, there is a common tradition for kind of seers and prophets to have the sort of aspect of hermaphrodites, you know, to be neither one or the other, to be kind of out of time and out of sex and out of the world. Tiresias, just to refresh, is a character who was he was actually transformed into a woman for a period of time because he came across two serpents fucking. I don't know if you can describe serpents as fucking, but they were copulating serpents, and depending upon which version of the tale you read, he either killed them or disturbed them in the midst of this act of copulation. And because they were sacred to Hera, he was basically transformed into a woman for a period of time as punishment. And then he actually becomes a man again. He's sort of taken out of this years later when he comes across two serpents copulating once again. And he either kills them or leaves them alone, depending upon which version you're referring to. And as a kind of reward for this reconciliatory act, he's transformed back into a man. So I do think it's very it's very evocative, this idea that Tiresias, of course, this ancient seer, is perceiving this scene. And I think Eliot is also very clearly drawing an analogy between the idea of these two serpents mating on their bellies in the dust with the two characters you're about to meet in this section.
Yes. So, yes, the Violet Hour, again, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, another reference to adventuring that we saw last time. Lots of references to the idea of the archetypical man, or the adventurer, the kind of hero, going out to sea. And there will be more and more frequent references to the sea and seafaring and boats as this goes along.
And of course, this would be a very specific type of sailor, because this is, of course, the sailor who goes out to, you know, daily to do, to, you know, to bring in the catch and then comes home at night.
Yeah, it's a sort of longshoreman.
Longshoreman, yeah.
So then, after that brief glimpse of the heroic, we then immediately come back to the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast. So she's come home after a day of work, and she's cleared up what she left there that morning. She lights the stove and lays out food in tins. Food in tins. So, you know, kind of archetypical bug woman here, you know, eating food out of the tins.
Yeah, tin food. She didn't wash up. She didn't do the washing up at breakfast.
No.
She comes home, has to clear it away, and then she pulls out basically tins for dinner.
Yes. Out of the window, perilously spread her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. So as the sun is finally like going away for the day, you just see her laundry perilously spread out of the windows. You know, it could... She's the idea is she's pushed here. So this is quite a hard life she's living. She's putting her clothes out the window to dry. She's eating food out of tins, and then it says, of course, on her divan are piled at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. Which it's interesting because I think between when it was written and now, the image has a different effect. The stocking, slippers, camisoles, and stays, because at the time that would have been a very mundane and quite vulgar line, basically. Whereas now it has even a slightly higher class aspect to it, because you know, the idea of a woman wearing stockings and camisoles, stays, you know, any women that do that now. But yes, and of course she doesn't have a bed; she has a divan, which is kind of a... I think we compared it to a sort of like a... It's a sort of like a chaise longue or a kind of couch.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting word to use here because it has an enormous connotation all throughout literature and art to kind of Oriental eroticism.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you look up kind of Orientalist depictions of harems, there will be divans in them with usually quite a voluptuous naked woman lying on it. You know, and the idea that it's a kind of bed of sin or a bed of pleasure, you know, it's a place for sex, essentially, is what Eliot is telling us here.
Or voluptuousness. I mean, we get this sort of image of like sort of Delacroix, the sort of Orientalist fantasy of women in harem. Which of course is contrasted with this typist, you know, who's got her miserable undergarments drying in the sun, who's eating food out of tins. I think he's deliberately sort of making this contrast in a very biting and satirical way. I don't think, and as you said, Hat, I don't think this comes through maybe to the modern reader as it certainly would have at the time. I think there's also in many places in the poem this allusion to the idea of modern people being homeless, you know, in other words, not being out of place and being sort of unable to fit in. I mean, I talked about the connotation of waste. You know, the wasteland, waste being something that is surplus to purposes or something that is spent and something that is removed from the world. I mean, what do you do with waste? Waste is expelled. You know, you expel waste from your body, you expel rubbish from your bins. And this woman is also sort of waste. I mean, she has no bed. She has no place to put her underclothes. She's drying them in the sun. She has no food. It's sort of displaced, a meal sealed in tins, like bodies in coffins. So she's very much like a sort of, like you said, a bug woman. The modern person who's in this miserable flat in London, existing at the barest end, between homelessness and and having a place to stay. So I think it's again, I think today it might you might sort of read some of these images as being kind of quaint and evocative of a period, but I think it's quite it's quite a bleak image of a human being.
Yes, and of course the tease. I think there's a subtle dig at modernity. The fact that she has a kind of a divan bed. This idea that there's a kind of commercial taste of the luxurious. You know, there's a kind of false luxuriousness in when she clearly doesn't really have anything else. You know. Just in the setting, and yes. Yeah, so then we get the reference to Tiresias again. He's perceived the scene. He's seen it all before. I too awaited the expected guest. The idea that, as you said, he's kind of a part of this. That he's been there. He's been on that bed. He's been both man and woman. He's done everything. Yeah. And so and then we get the young man Carbuncula arrives now. Carbuncula. So. It's a very blunt, one-word way of saying that this man is really not good-looking. He's quite almost sort of deformed. You know, the word carbuncular would imply. Like he's
carbuncles. I mean, they're sort of like pus-filled. You know, sort of like spotty. You know, he's sort of got sort of boils or you know, kind of oozing. You know, it's a very unpleasant image. You know, I think
it really is.
There's a Diane Arbus. There's a Diane Arbus photograph of a young man. I think it was taken in the late 1960s or early 70s of a young man at a sort of American political rally. I believe he's holding like an American flag and he's got a like a sort of plastic boater hat on, and he's just the scabbiest, most spotty, miserable person. And that's the kind of picture I always call up when I read this.
Yes, I mean, basically, imagine the Penguin from Batman. I think would be a good call there to this young man, and he's a small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. So. There's a few things to unpack here. So first of all, he's a house agent's clerk. So he's kind of a working boy. He's only a clerk, again, member of the middle class, kind of white collar job. And I think we discussed in our analysis before last time stream the fact that there was an enormous housing crisis in London and in the UK in general at the time, quite even more severe than we have now, because basically after the war, all these soldiers and other such people came home, and there had been a housing issue before the war, and now it was even worse. And the government of Lloyd George promised to start a scheme called Homes for Heroes, where they were going to build these enormous new streets and towns and, you know, huge new parks of homes for all these men to live in, which of course never happened. It was basically a scam. It never went through. And so, yes, I think part of the fact that she's living in this tiny room with barely any room for anything and just, you know, eating food out of tins, that she doesn't have anywhere else to go. She's crammed in here because she doesn't have a house. And the fact that this man is a small house agent's clerk, and yet he's so self-assured, he's so confident, you know, like a Bradford millionaire. That, you know, of course, Bradford, as we will know, is a kind of mill town. It popped up due to industrialism in the 1800s as a city. And a Bradford millionaire, this kind of nouveau riche, you know, the idea that this is just a person who has come up into the middle classes and is wearing a silk hat, a silk top hat, basically. You know, the idea that it sits on his head perfectly. He's playing the part wonderfully. And of course, him being a small house agent's clerk, it's only a small house agent and he's only a clerk. But because of the way things are, because of the astronomical prices you could charge for rent and housing, this house agent is doing enormously well, I think is the implication. You know, that there is this kind of class of people doing very well out of the situation, as there always is. And he's of course come to this house to see this girl for a certain reason. So he's arrived. He's got one bold stare, and the time is now propitious. As he guesses, the meal is ended. She is bored and tired, and he, it says, endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. And this word unreproved, quite masterfully employed here, because unreproved means there has been wrongdoing that hasn't been punished. So if there was a known thief who stole something and the police decided not to catch him, even though they knew who he was, that would be unreproved. It means that a wrong has been committed, which has not been chased up, essentially. So it means that she's not happy with this. She's not enjoying it, but she's not saying no either. She doesn't want it. And then, flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. So, you know, again, he's leaping upon this girl, you know, getting his hands all over her, obviously exploring hands, no defense. She's not putting up any resistance because she just doesn't care. She's just not bothered at this point. And then his vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. So what you have here is he thinks he's being, it seems, he's being very kind of, to him, this is a kind of vain act. He's pleased with himself. The fact that she's not, she doesn't want it, but she also doesn't not want it, is pleasing to him in some way. It appeals to his sense of vanity. So then, if you could just scroll the poem down a few lines, and we'll move on. Oh, there we go. So then, I, Tiresias, have forsuffered all and acted on this same divan or bed. I, who have sat by thieves below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead. So basically, again, the idea that Tiresias is this eternal character and that none of this is new, none of this is anything that's happened, that none of this is something particular to modernity. Tiresias has seen all of this before. He's seen this a thousand times. He has sat by thieves below the wall. Eliot is taking us back to the ancient world now. He's taking us to, you know, Thebes beneath the wall, and walked among the lowest of the dead. He's been there and he's seen all that humanity has to offer. And he's seen this before. So then that was all in brackets. So it's cut straight back in. He bestows one final patronizing kiss. So, you know, it's just one last, doesn't really mean it, feeling really happy with himself for having been able to do this with the girl. And then he gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. So there's no light in the stairwell. And he gropes his way, of course. Quite an obvious sexual connotation there with grope.
Yes, he's just groped her unlit stairs, so to speak.
Yes. There you go. And then she turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. So again, she just doesn't care. She just doesn't, like, she's not really there at the moment. She's not thinking about any of this. And her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, I'm glad it's over. and that's that. that's what's happening in this room.
It's a reduction of the kind of, you know, the sacred act of copulation, which of course leads to the creation of new life. It's the reduction of this to a purely mechanical, unmeaningful, unwanted, you know, not even scandalous, not even degenerate. I mean, just boring, you know, just completely unmoving in any way. You know, there's no lust here, like, certainly I'm not on her part. There's no kind of connection. There's no nothing fulfilled. You know, she just basically allowed herself to be used. And unlike, of course, the Philomel and Tereus, she, you know, she, there's no revenge, there's no transformation into birds, you know, there's no there's no transcendence at the end of this moment. You know, what does she do? That's done. I'm glad it's over. And then this next section kind of puts an even more miserable cap on it all.
Paces about her room again alone, smooths her hair with an automatic hand, and puts a record on the gramophone.
Yeah, which is a very T.S. Eliot line.
Yeah, master of the anticlimax was T.S. Eliot. Anyway, so yes, as you say, we'll pick up the pace a bit, I think. So try and get this a bit quicker. So so this next section, this is where we start to get Wagnerian, isn't it?
Yes, we get that. This is sort of the lead into that. This line isn't. This is also from you quoted this poem earlier. This music crept by me upon the waters. I can't remember which poem that was. That's from, but it's another direct quotation from the Tempest. Sorry, yeah, that's getting a bit muddled.
Well, there is a lot going on here.
Yes, and along the Strand up Queen Victoria Street, a city, I can sometimes hear, beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street. So again, he's setting this in a very specific location. He's giving very specific concrete images to this scene. The pleasant winding of a mandoline, as Eliot says in his reading, and a clatter and a chatter from within. Where fishermen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendor of Ionian white and gold. And so he's there very deftly in a couple of lines, contrasted this public bar with a church. Yeah.
Pub church, kind of flicking between each one and the Ionian white and gold. So then we move on to what is sort of a song.
Let me give just a little bit of explanation of this. So as I said, Eliot draws very heavily on Richard Wagner and Wagner's The Ring cycle, The Ring des Nibelungen, and which of course has sort of multiple parts. The Ring cycle is a very sort of complex bit of multimedia. In a way, it was very much a kind of, I would say, huge sort of push towards the modern idea of entertainment. I mean, you know, the Wagnerian opera was very much the kind of, multimedia, IMAX, presentation of its day. It was a giant spectacle. It was this complete reimagining of what the kind of theater was and what the opera was, and so in a way, it's a very kind of something we recognize. I mean, I think it within Wagner are the seeds of sort of today's media culture and the way we sort of think about things like films. A lot of those tropes were kind of established in the Wagnerian theater of the day. But the Ring cycle it draws upon, as I said, these Icelandic epics, the Eddas, but it also draws a bit from Germanic myths of the Nibelungen, and partially, draws from Wagner himself. I mean, he made up, bits and pieces, and there's lots of kind of bits of his own mythology there. And it's very, again, very much akin to Tolkien, if we want to find an English language sort of comparison. And as I said, Tolkien drew heavily from Wagner as well. But I didn't want to go over the entire story of the Ring cycle, but very, very specifically, this section refers to three characters from The Ring called the Rhine Maidens. The Rhine Maidens are very interesting because they're three characters. They're called Voglinda, Velgunda, and Fothilda. But they're kind of three parts, but they all kind of work as one entity. They're not really, even though they're three different sort of characters, three figures on this the drama, they operate as one. And I wonder also if Eliot was by extension slightly referring to the idea of the Trinity, you know, the sort of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the three in one, because the Rhine Maidens sort of operate like that. They're the first and last characters who appear in the ring. So the first to appear on the stage, and the very last to appear on the stage. The end of the ring cycle is called the Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods.
Twilight of the Gods.
The destruction of the gods, in which basically all the gods burn to ash in fire. I mean, everyone at the end of the ring cycle dies, except for the Rhine Maidens. And it is they who pull the ring of the Nibelungen out of the ashes of Brunhilde's ashes, and rescue it from the hand of man. And of course, if you're familiar with, you know, Tolkien, again, he drew very heavily from the ring cycle for the idea of the One Ring and the rings of power. And so there is a kind of Gollum character in the ring cycle who is the last to kind of make a clutch at this. But basically, the Rhine Maidens cause the Rhine, the banks of the Rhine, to swell up and return the gold to them. So the Rhine Maidens are kind of these almost innocent primal spirits or primal keepers of the Rhine River. And they're charged with keeping the gold, thus Rhine gold. They're charged with sort of keeping this sacred gold, which is basically stolen from them and used to forge the ring in the opera. So what Eliot is doing here is that he is basically creating his own characters, which I think he referred to as the Thames Maidens. Like in Wagner's conception, there are three Thames Maidens, and here we get the Thames Maidens, the three different songs from the Thames Maidens. So you can kind of think of each of these sections that's separated by this line, Wea-la-la-la-ya, as being the voices of each of these three maidens. But as I said, they're three separate maidens, but they speak as one entity, and so they're the voice of the River Thames. And so he's literally giving this kind of
each other.
Yeah, personification of it. And interestingly, Wagner, well, we'll get to that when we get to this one line there. I find amusing a quote from George Bernard Shaw, who wrote an explication of Wagner's Ring Cycle. And he described the Rhine Maidens as, quote, thoughtless, elemental, only half real things, very much like modern young ladies. which I thought was quite appropriate, certainly in the context of the wasteland. So the first of the Thames Maidens says, "The river sweats, oil and tar, the barges drift with a turning tide, red sails wide to leeward swing on the heavy spar, the barges wash drifting log down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs." And then we get this line, "Wea-la-la, la-ya, wa-la-la, la la la," and this is a direct quotation from Wagner, from the Ring Cycle. I'm actually looking at the score right now, and I'm not going to attempt to sing it. I think we can get away with just a few seconds of I'm going to play. Well, I think it's because it's being played through my speakers and it's going to be very short. Yeah. I'm going to talk during it. But anyway, This is the Rhine Maidens in the Götterdämmerung. This is the lament to the lost Rhine God. Rhine God! You know, they sing this this line, and then they sing this wail-a-la-la-ya, and this is what it sounds like.
Oh,
So la 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 la. And when you listen to like Eliot's reading, he sort of sings the line, and Mr. Hat sort of gave a musical lilt to that line. But that is the origin of it. This is a part of the Wasteland that always stumps people. If you're not familiar with Wagner and with the Ring cycle, and you're not familiar with the Rhine Maids, you're not going to know what the hell Whale La 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 is. But that is what it's from. So
yeah,
so he's very friend. Yeah, he's very specifically referring to it there. And then we get the second of Thames Maids, who says Elizabeth and Leicester. Do you want to say anything about that? I mean, that's a very specific reference.
Elizabeth and Leicester is, according to Eliot, from a biography, a Victorian book about Queen Elizabeth I. There's a letter of, I think, a Spanish official to King Philip of Spain, where he says, "In the afternoon, we were in a barge watching the games on the river. The Queen was alone with Lord Robert and myself on the poop," meaning the poop deck, "when they began to talk nonsense and went so far that Lord Robert said at last, as I was on the spot, there was no reason why they should not be married if the Queen pleased." So a bit of flirty talk between Elizabeth,
Elizabeth and Leicester. Yeah.
And Lord Robert. Yeah. Basically.
And again, then we get the rest beating oars. The stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold. Which is a nice echo of the splendors of Ionian white and gold that we got a few lines before. The brisk swell rippled both shores. Southwest wind carried down the stream the peal of bells, white towers. And then we get the third Rhine, Thames maiden, who tells sort of her story. Trams and dusty trees, Highbury bore me. Richmond and Kew undid me. By Richmond I raised my knees pine upon the floor of a narrow canoe.
Yes.
And then continues. Goes on and says, my feet are at Morgate, my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? On Margate sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. Broken fingernails of dirty hands, my people humble, who expect nothing. And again, this is a much more personal line from Third Thames Maiden, sort of talking about her the attempt, this sort of seduction, and we get echoes in this verse of the scene that we just saw of typist and the carbuncular young man, this seduction, which is sort of what led to the Rhine maidens giving up the gold in the first place. This sort of trick by a young man.
And then we have this line, to Carthage then I came, which is where we begin to get into St. Augustine and the confession. This is very important because Eliot would draw Confessions perhaps more than any other work for the rest of his career, basically. The four quartets, the later poetry, is full of allusions to Augustine. He's really a fan, if you want to say, of St. Augustine, and he draws very heavily from it. This, to Carthage then I came, which is of course so he said, St. Augustine says, to Carthage then I came, where a cauldron of unholy loves sang all about mine ears, referencing the rather scurrilous activities that St. Augustine got up to in North Africa, where he was from. Where are we going on to then?
So then we have this line, burning, 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 burning. And this draws us back to the title of this section, which is the Fire Sermon, which, as I said, is a reference to the Fire Sermon, which is a famous sermon given by the Buddha. It is called the, I, I'm going to butchered this, you'll have to forgive me, but it's called the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, aka the Fire Sermon. And I will just read a little bit of it, a translation of it. This is part of what's called the Pali Canon of Buddhist text.
Yes.
Thus I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Gaya, together with 1,000 bhikkhus, which are male Buddhist monks. He then addressed the monks. Monks, all is burning. And what is the all that is burning? The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. Also, whatever is felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact for its indispensable condition, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hate, with the fire of delusion. I say it is burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, with lamentations, with pains, with griefs, with despairs. And it goes on basically to describe the senses, the kind of our contact with the material world, as being the source of one of the great sources of suffering. So this is I think a very sort of specific reference. I believe in the Eliot's notes he makes a comparison between this and the Sermon on the Mount, which is a bit of a bold claim. I can certainly see the corollary, what the corollary would be.
It's right here. The complete text of the Buddha's Fire Sermon, which corresponds in importance to the Sermon on the Mount, from which these words are taken, will be found translated.
There are many translations of it, and you certainly, you know, you may want to read the whole thing. But through this sermon, which is quite short, but it describes the kind of the turning away from the burning lusts and from the kind of deceit and hate and trickery of the senses, and basically the estrangement from the senses. At the end of this, of course, the monks were liberated, and they were clinging no more, you know. This sort of idea of the turning away from sense, the turning away from decadence, and this idea of burning, you know, cleansing, and the line we got before it was "to Carthage then I came," which also reminds you of Cartago Delenda Est, you know, Carthage is being destroyed. This idea of the kind of, the destruction and the cleansing of all that is broken.
Yes. Burning.
Burning.
Burning. I mean, there you go. Lord, thou pluckest me out, from the Confessions again, of course.
Yeah. So, we very, very clear. I mean, within those five lines there, we've got a classical allusion. We've got an allusion to Buddhism. We've got an allusion to St. Augustine, so drawing on, these sort of very divergent sources. I mean, we've just got a tripartite lament from the Thames Maidens. It gives you an idea of the kind of diversity of sources and ways of thinking, you know. And it's very much a sort of symptomatic of the modern person. We have this idea of the kind of modern intellectual, you know, or the 60s, you know, the kind of 1960s disillusioned youth turning to Buddhism, turning to Hinduism, turning to mysticism, you know, and again, looking elsewhere for meaning, this sense of disillusionment with one's own roots, this disillusionment with the basis of one's own tradition culture is very much a kind of symptom of the modern man.
Yes, indeed. And then, of course, so that is the kind of quite terrifying close of the fire sermon. Not very much left of the poem to get through now. Not a huge amount as such. But so we have this, well, we have this very short part four, which is simply called Death by Water.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, this is one of the most interesting bits of the poem from a sort of poetic point of view, or as a kind of compositional aspect. So, I mean, we have Phlebas the Phoenician. And I'll tell you more about him in a moment. But so, a fortnight dead. So, it's essentially, he drowned at sea. And, you know, it's this kind of, it's a kind of counterpoint to all the ideas in this poem of heroic adventure, of men seafaring out to you know, go and conquer new lands or see new things or just adventure for the hell of it. We get this, which is, of course, Phlebas the Phoenician, who is simply dead at the bottom of the ocean. He entered the whirlpool, entering the whirlpool. And then we get Gentile or Jew, oh, you who turn the wheel and look to windward, you know, you who sail into the wind, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. Just remember that not everybody is going to be Odysseus. You know, some of you are going to be Phlebas the Phoenician, dead at the bottom of the ocean. And what hammers this home is the fact that Phlebas the Phoenician doesn't exist. There is no classical character called Phlebas the Phoenician. Eliot made it up. It's a fiction. It's just a name that he concocted that sounds vaguely classical. And I do believe that he is playing a joke on the reader, basically. He knows that there will be kind of autistic academics that would have combed through, you know, page after page after page of classical text to find who this Phlebas the Phoenician was. What great classical work is Eliot referencing here? But no, he doesn't exist. So, yes, he is an unknown, forgotten Phoenician who now lies at the bottom of the sea. That's really,
yeah.
That's really,
so I'm not entirely convinced, because I do think that he, even though you're right, I mean, there isn't this is not a specific character, but I do think that he is very clearly drawing from, like, Phoenician is very concrete, you know, that's a very specific reference. I don't know, I do think he is drawing up kind of this, he's drawing up classical allusions, but yes, you're, as you said, not to a specific character that is Eliot's creation alone. Also remember that this section is literally predicted by Madame Sosostris in the first part of The Wasteland. She says fear death by water. And then we very specifically get death by water. And there was, again, several references to the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those were pearls that were his eyes, you know, which is a reference to the tempest again. So so this is almost the kind of prophecy coming.
Yes. Very much so. The as we said last time, all the prophecies predicted by Madame Sosostris, you know, they come true in some way in the poem. They appear again.
Yeah.
So yes, and then that's simply the end of that section. And we get on to the last part of the poem. What the thunder said. Do you want to start off with this, Mr. D?
Well, I'll give a little bit. So this section, the title of this section and a lot of the imagery of this section refers to another of the great faiths of the world, which is to Hinduism. Yes. We will talk about that source when it comes up. But this is the kind of culmination of the poem. And I would say, if anything, that this is the kind of vision or prophecy of the future. You know, so much of the poem was the kind of explication of the past and the kind of reporting of the dire condition of the present world. And this part of the poem is very much a kind of apocalyptic vision. This is the revelation at the end of the testament that Eliot has given us. And so we get this line: after the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places. And I always took these three lines as being a very short summation of the three ages of man, or the three ages of history. So
yes,
torchlight red on sweaty faces, I think, evokes this notion of the primitive man, the sort of primitive dawn of tribal societies and primitive rites before civilization, yes, and before, you know, before faith and before, you know, the deliverance of from the primitive condition. And then we get the frosty silence in the garden, you know, the garden, very much like Marvell, the garden as a man-made place, as sort of nature arranged by man. And of course, frosty silence, you know, this sort of very much the images evoked in the previous parts of the poem of kind of things stifled and things hibernating and things in this state that is neither living nor dead. And then, of course, the future, which is, of course, agony in stony places. This sort of the agony of the last days of man amongst the ruins, the barrens and the rocks. Yes. And so so I always quite like that little section there. The shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains. And so much of the beginning of this section is, I would say, almost hallucinatory. You know, these are the kind of slightly half mad ravings of someone, you know, of a starving man, or a man driven mad by circumstances or by desperation, or the man who is dying of thirst, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we get this very clear allusion to the idea of parched, the idea of being dry. But it's not just thirst. It's not just physical thirst. It's a spiritual thirst. You know, this is modern man parched from the lack of contact with the renewing and regenerating and holy water. Yes. You know,
indeed. Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. I think, again, this poem is not as inaccessible as many critics pretend it is. I think it's really quite clear in a lot of parts. Yeah. You know, this idea of the sterility and the idea of kind of madness being induced because of the thirst. You know, you're going mad with thirst. You can't drink, no matter how much you want to. I was going to say the verses that most of the verses in this section don't have much punctuation at all. The idea that it's kind of manic, you know.
Yes, exactly. The I mean, in fact, there's no punctuation at all until we get to the sort of fourth stanza, and then again the punctuation almost leaves until, you know, near the middle or beginning of the end of the poem. So. Yes, and I think that it does imply this kind of breathlessness. I mean, even the way this is written, here is no water, but only rock, rock and no water, and the sandy road, the road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. And again, it's constantly kind of these feedback loops back to the word rock, back to the word water, water and rock and rock and water and spring and sterile thunder. You know, and it's this piling up of images, you know, that wonderful kind of sinister image of the dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. And as we said, I mean, this is very visceral writing. This is a very sort of imagistic and very clear. You know, there's nothing esoteric about this moment in the poem.
No. We are dying of drought, basically.
Yeah.
Yes. So how much more in depth should we go on this part here, or should we scroll down?
I think we scroll down. So, you know, again, we get a no water. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, spring, a pool among the rock, if there was sound of water only. I mean, these are the kind of breathless, desperate utterances, you know, of the kind of dying man.
And again, for
Eliot, this was not just physical death; this was spiritual death.
Yes.
Now I want to bring up my little bit. I've always been troubled by this, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine tree.
Oh yes, here we go.
Drip, drop, drip, drop, drop, drop.
Eliot debunked.
Very debunking here, because in Eliot's note. This is Turdus Aeon Lashkai Palayasi, the hermit thrush, which I have heard in Quebec County. Chapman says, Handbook of Birds of East and North America, it is most at home in secluded woodlands and thickety retreats. Its notes are not remarkable for variety of volume, but in purity and sweetness of tone and exquisite modulation, they are unequaled. Its water-dripping song is justly celebrated. So we made note of the fact that perhaps Eliot's notes should not be trusted. I mean, Eliot almost becomes an unreliable narrator. If you have heard a hermit thrush, and I don't have any paired, unfortunately, to play, but if you go on the internet, there's many, many resources for bird songs. There's whole websites full of them. You can listen to every song that the hermit thrush makes, and
the British Society of Birds, I believe, has every bird call.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is no song that the hermit thrush makes that sounds like drip, drop, 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 drop. There is no water dripping song associated with hermit thrush. And so I actually found a short paper that someone else had written, basically also bringing this up. I was so excited because I thought that I was the only one who'd ever noticed this, the fact that this didn't make any sense. Because, of course, it's, you know, when I was going through this poem, I was combing through it and very excitedly trying to kind of dig up all these things and confirm them. And that's not true. It doesn't make that sound. But yeah, there's a short paper that someone wrote talking about this. And their theory is that he's actually referring to the call of the saw-whet owl, which is a tiny little owl that lives in the northern hemispheres of the world, and it does make a song. It does make a noise that is drip, drop, 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 drop. But yeah, so if I may be permitted to say that this can only be viewed as a mistake by Eliot. I mean, of course,
bold claims there.
It's a bold claim. I mean, of course, as a poet, you know, hermit thrush is one. It sounds wonderful. You couldn't say where the saw-whet owl sings in the pine trees. It doesn't have the same force.
No. So, well, I don't know. It's not unpoetic. Saw-whet owl.
Anyway, so this is completely inconsequential and it doesn't matter. But I did, you know, being the deepest lore, being a place of a profound insignificance in autism, I did think it was necessary to mention the fact that the hermit thrush actually the hermit thrush did not go direct
actually drop. Yeah,
anyway, what's next, Pat?
All right, AA's just showing everyone the notes there on the annotated edition. So then we got, who is the third who always walks, oh, there we go, Yeah. Yeah. So. I'm gonna use this to reinforce my claim about the idea of men and women morphing into one, and the idea that all forms are kind of you don't have a certainty of the form anymore, because you've got this line here: a gilding wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman. Who is that on the other side of you? And the third, who always walks beside you, the third. Just check that, because the third who always walks behind you. So, Elliot says 360.
Before you say about Elliot's notes, I want to say that this is one example of where I hated Elliot's notes. Because I always I love this little section. It's such a kind of almost chilling and foreboding and mysterious little section. And I was always quite captivated by it. You know, who is that on the other side of you? This idea of the shadow. You know, I'm thinking, of course, the man and his Jungian shadow, and you know, the shadow of history and such. And then you read Eliot's notes, and why would you ruin it?
This is the most autistic, obscure reference in the whole poem, I think. Like, I can't imagine how anyone, like, probably for a long time after this poem was published, could actually get what the hell this was talking about. But according to Eliot's notes, so we've got note 360. The following lines were stimulated by the account of one of the Antarctic expeditions. I forget which, but I think one of Shackleton's. It was related that the party of explorers, at the extremity of their strength, had the constant delusion that there was one more member than could actually be counted. That's it, apparently.
Yeah, so he takes this wonderfully mysterious, unsettling little image and just sort of makes it mundane. Although I will say that his note reminds me, and this little section reminds me. Do you remember, Hat, when we watched bits of Akira Kurosawa's Dreams?
Yes, I remember it very well.
Do you remember the section about the Japanese mountaineers?
Yes, that's right. Going up, yes.
Yeah, when they were in the dark, and they were lost, and they were beginning to freeze.
They weren't certain of anything.
They were visited by a figure wrapped in a mantle. Yes.
Yes.
Which is a very, very chilling. If you've never seen that film, I think it's flawed as a film, but some of the vignettes in that film are absolutely astounding. And notably that one. This figure, you know, and again, I was always trying to, you know, the Trinity, you know. No, it's
well, according Shackleton. Well, according to the author of this edition with the notes, he says the passage also parallels the story of Christ's resurrection in Luke 24:13. In this story, two of Christ's disciples meet a stranger on the road as they are traveling to. I can't pronounce. Is it Emmaus? Emmaus.
Emmaus, I think. Yeah.
Emmaus. The stranger is the resurrected Christ, but the disciples do not recognize him. As they continue, Christ chastises them for their lack of faith. The third figure in the Wastelands rendition of the story is hooded, as are the chaotic hordes in the next passage. So the editor here thinks it's a reference to the Luke after the resurrection.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because of course, I mean, you know, since it was recently Easter, I tweeted out one of my favorite pictures, which is Caravaggio's The Supper at Emmaus, and it is the moment. So they're basically they don't recognize Christ. I mean, it's not that they're like he's like in costume. It's that they are spiritually, you know, it's the scales are over their eyes, and they are looking at him, but they cannot see him because they cannot conceive. They cannot conceive that he was resurrected. And then he, the moment he blesses the meal that they have, basically the scales fall from their eyes, and they realize who it is. And immediately he disappears from them. You know, he's gone away. Yes. and they're, you know, they're struck with the fact that they were with him, and they did not see because they did not have the faith to conceive that he would return to them. So yeah, I think that's certainly a good interpretation of that as well.
Yes. And so then we have that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation, and we get these hooded hordes. And this is truly quite horrific, next bit. Yeah. So this is a reference to an essay by Hermann Hesse, which we actually got our young German friend arrive, who will be referenced endlessly, but never appear, I think, on this channel. We got him to read the original German that Eliot notes, and the translation is from the essay A Glimpse into Chaos, and he says, "Already half of Europe, already at last the eastern half of Europe, is on the way to chaos, driving drunk on holy delusion along the edge of an abyss and singing to it, drunk songs and hymnals like Dmitri Karamazov sang. Over these songs, the commoner laughs scornfully. The saint and seer listens with tears on her cheeks." So, basically, this is talking about the decline of the world after the First World War, especially in the East, with the rise of communism. And there's a reference to Karamazov, who is one of the brothers Karamazov from Dostoevsky, who are, you know, they sort of foolish men or in some way flawed, variously. And of course, so you got this imagery, you know, if we could just scroll down a bit, we've got, you know, the sound high in air, and then you've got the, go up a bit. There we go. Ringed by the flat horizon. So we, so cracks and reforms and burst in the violet air, and another reference to the violet air. Falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. So this, again, this kind of mystical, quite psychedelic vision of hordes swarming, stumbling over the plains in cracked earth, cracked implying that it's dry and barren of water. There's only the horizon. There's nothing between them and the horizon, and then it's all just collapsing in on itself. You know, just pure kind of apocalypticism now. Any thoughts on this bit, Mr. D?
No, I would certainly agree with that interpretation. Yeah, it's quite miserable. I mean, this is also kind of calls back to in the first part of the poem, we actually get during the section about Madame Sesostris doing the reading, we get the faceless crowds and a hooded figure as well. You know, she cannot see, you know, what he carries on his back and all of this. So this is again a kind of callback to that, and to the various prophets that we've met in the course of the poem. This line. Well, we get violet air, which again a sort of evocation of the violet hour that I talked about before, and the collapsing towers. And this line, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal, is, I can't remember where I read it, but may have been inspired by a dream that Bertrand Russell had and told to Eliot, where he had sort of seen this vision of the cities of the world sort of evaporating into that they basically cease to exist.
Yes. Just purely kind of apocalyptic, as I say. So then we have a woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings.
Yeah, this section.
Oh, this is your favorite bit.
another favorite bit of mine. I mean, this is just such a... It's a horrifying... I mean, think about it. Just, again, think about the string of images here. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on the string. So this woman with long hair, long black hair, pulls it out
music.
And then begins to play music on it as if it's a stringed instrument. Meanwhile, bats... with baby faces in, again, the violet light, whistled and beat their wing and crawled head downward down a blackened wall.
Crawling down the wall.
These bats with baby faces whistling and crawling down a wall. And then again, upside down in air with towers tolling reminiscent bells. And then voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. And you know, this is just another collection of quite horrible images. And finishing, of course, with this idea of an empty cistern, an exhausted well, which is very much a kind of reference to this Christian idea of being drained of faith. You know, what is the worth of a well that cannot produce water anymore? You know, this spiritual dryness again.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it is quite a horrific section. And then we kind of go back to, you know, empty cisterns, exhausted wells. Again, just no water. Everything's dry. Everything's dying. Decayed hole among the mountains.
Yes, and so we get this. Yes, this image of the abandoned church. You know, the church as an empty ruin. Only the wind's home, the swinging door, the dry bones can harm no one. And I think this is, of course, a quite a powerful, you know, image. Certainly, for Eliot, and would become even more so after his conversion. You know, was this idea that even the kind of faith that had sustained the West was being abandoned and left to the wind. But what comes? I mean, what comes when we're given this image of even the church being a ruin?
Abandoned and empty.
A cock, a bird, stood on the roof tree, singing its song, a flash of lightning, a damp gust, and rain. The water comes. And so, even after all this bleak prophecy, the deluge, the rain will come, the water will come. I have this, you know, image of the Ents breaking the dam and flooding the fires of Isengard with the, yes, with the purifying water. You know, and again, the water comes. So we're given this very bleak prophecy, but we're also reminded that in the end, you know, there is renewal possible and promised, you know.
Remember, as we talked about last week, this is not really a nihilistic poem as such. It has an apocalyptic vision, but there's always the idea of renewal. This is a kind of cyclical idea that everything will grow again. But, you know, the idea that it's a season, you know, this is the spring, the barren spring, and eventually there will come a spring where things rejuvenate. I believe, yeah. Anyway. That's quite up to interpretation. But yes. Yes, bringing rain. So then we got Ganga was sunken, which is, of course, a term for the Ganges.
Yeah, Ganga is an old term for the Ganges. Yes. And also, in a couple of lines later, we get Himavant, which is an old term, which is a term for the peak of the Himalayas. So,
And
the jungle crouched, humped in silence, and then spake the thunder. So, we had this idea of the flash of lightning, and we had, you know, he evoked this image of sterile thunder. So of course we have this idea of thunder being the presaging rain. You know, when you hear thunder, you know that the rain is going to come. But of course Eliot had given us sterile thunder before. But then we get the thunder, the voice of the thunder. And this is, of course, refers to the title of the section, What the Thunder Said. And this is from the Upanishads.
Mm-hmm.
So we had You know, we had the sort of evocation of the fire sermon with Buddhism, and now we get the, you know, the sort of Hindu tradition. And let me pull up the specific one. So the Upanishads, if people aren't aware, are the sort of Vedic texts, these the sort of foundational texts that are the... Sorry, I'm sunking. I'm trying to search through notes. That are the foundations of, you know, of Hinduism. And I certainly can't do them justice because it's not a sort of speciality of me, of mine. The specific one of the Upanishads that Eliot refers to is the fifth Adhyaya, first Brahmana, and I actually have the. This part is called by another name, but there is no way I'm going to try to pronounce it. basically, so I just to read what this particular Upanishad says. It's detailing a scene where Pragapati, which is the sort of the creator, has gathered together gods, the devas, men, and Asuras, who are kind of the demons. The threefold descendants of Pragapati, gods, men, and Asuras, dwelt as Brahmacharans, students, with their father Pragapati. Having finished their studentship, the gods said, "Tell us something, sir." He told them the syllable Da. Then he said, "Do you understand?" They said, "We did understand. You told us, Damyata, be subdued." "Yes," he said, "you have understood." Then the men said to him, "Tell us something, sir." He told them the syllable Da. Then he said, "Did you understand?" They said, "We did understand. You told us, Datta, to give." "Yes," he said, "you have understood." Then the Asuras said to him, "Tell us something, sir." He told them the same syllable, Da. Then he said, "Did you understand?" They said, "We did understand. You told us, Dayadvam, be merciful." "Yes," he said, "you have understood." The divine voice of thunder repeats the same, Da, Da, Da. That is, be subdued, give, be merciful. Therefore, let that triad be taught, subduing, giving, and mercy. And I think it's quite notable. Again, we get this evocation of a trinity, of a triad. Yes. You know, in this case, of course, it's the devas, men, and the demons, you know, and the evil spirits. Mm-hmm. You know, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. And this is quite interesting, of course, because each of these groups, which has a different role in the universe, in creation, yes, gods and men and demons, and each of them are told the same syllable. He says Da to each of them, and each of them hears that as a different concept. And so,
yes,
Eliot, you know, very deliberately evokes this whole exchange in most of the rest of the poem. Da, da, da. We get the three syllables again: Datta, Dayadvam, and Damyata. You know, and again, which is to be subdued, to hold back, and that is the province of the gods. To give, and which is the province of men, to be charitable, and then to be merciful is the province of the evil spirits. You know.
Yes.
It was a bit long-winded, but just to explain again what this Da, Datta, Dayadvam, Damyata, and again, Eliot is using yet another tradition to kind of circle around and talk about his idea of you know, of in what form renewal will come. And, you know, yes.
Yes, I mean, it's a kind of, I mean, how do you feel about the kind of stylistic choice to introduce kind of Eastern mythology and kind of philosophy into the poem in such a kind of blunt way? You know, kind of putting it bare, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, as I said, I think that is a bit, of a trope of modernism, you know, this idea of, as modern men, we are kind of open to all of the kind of human experience, and in a way that there's this, there was this sense of universalism that you could draw from, you know, all the traditions and ways of the world and find this kind of commonality amongst men.
Yes.
I mean, even for Eliot, you know, with this extraordinarily grim view of the modern condition, in a way is affirming this idea of the universal experience, that again, he can turn to these traditions, these sort of foreign traditions, or these past traditions, you know, these myths, these legends, yes. And he can find prophecy of what is to come, or at least a description of what is in the world of his day.
Indeed. Yeah. So, should we move down the poem a bit?
Yeah.
Go to. So yes,
my friend, blood shaking my heart. I think that's a part we should talk about.
Yes, blood shaking my heart. The awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. By this and this only, we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries. So, I mean, it's kind of an almost isolated poetic section where we've got this image of the blood shaking the heart, this kind of terror, this foreboding, and this moment surrender which an age of prudence can never retract. So, kind of a general address to the condition of the world, and the idea that there's been an age of prudence, that a moment's surrender has let go, and it kind of ties into the idea of for me, at least, for morality. The idea that, you know, it doesn't matter how prudent you are, all it takes is one slip up and, you know, your prudence is gone to waste, basically.
Mm. And of course we got an example of that with the typist surrendering, the moment surrender to this young man, you know.
Yes, indeed. Yes, not to found on a picture. His memory straight by the beneficent spider, or yeah, under seals broken by the lean solicitor. So this is a reference to apparently to John Webster in a play called The White Devil.
The White Devil again.
It says, they'll remarry ere the worm pierce your winding sheet, ere the spider make a thin curtain for your epitaphs. Is what this is apparently referencing in our empty rooms. So basically, the idea is that you know, not to be found in our obituaries. So the idea that these things being lost to time, these actions and these things that these people live by, being lost, and the kind of lean, the seals broken by the lean solicitor. So the idea that nothing in what they'll leave behind will record it, then of course the empty rooms, because, you know, things are barren. And then we return to the...
Well, also this idea that these things that define us the most intimately, the things that define our morality, our spirituality, are not the achievements that would be written about. These are not the monuments that you would think of. These are the, you know, they're not the kind of, you know, things sealed in a tomb. You know, these are not the treasures of Tutankhamun that are found under the broken seal. You know, that these are the awful moment of the awful daring of a moment's surrender. You know, these are these sort of things known only to us and taken by us to the grave and God alone.
Indeed. And we have a return to the Diadvam, which we've covered. And then we get this reference to the key in the prison. The key in the prison. So I have heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. Now, this is quite complicated. So that part of this is a reference to Dante, the Inferno, where in one of the levels of hell, he meets Count Ugolino, who was an Italian nobleman who was locked in a tower with his sons and grandsons and left to starve. And he recounts the story and he says, "Below, I heard them nailing up the door of the horrible tower," which is what this is referencing, according to Eliot. And it also draws from a section from F.H. Bradley, who was a philosopher, who wrote a book called Appearance and Reality. And his whole argument was that each person's experience of the world is unique and that all communication between beings is ambiguous. And T.S. Eliot wrote a PhD dissertation thesis work on F.H. Bradley's book. He never went back to Harvard to do his vocal exam, though. So he never actually got it, but he did write and submit the dissertation. And the quote this section is leading from is, "My external sensations are no less private to myself than are my thoughts or feelings. In either case, my experience falls within my own circle, a circle closed on the outside. And with all its elements alike, every sphere is opaque to the others which surround it. In brief, regarded as an existence that appears in a soul, the whole world for each is peculiar and private to that soul." So yeah, that's the basic idea of the philosophy there. And this idea that if you can think of a key, then you have a prison. And the idea that, you know, this idea that men are kind of locked up in a way, that there's the kind of the inability to get away from what we are, I suppose. Thinking of the key. And then one of the more standout lines from the poem, I think, is this: "Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus." Very cryptic. This is a bit, these two lines, I have yet to actually figure out anything about them. I'm quite stumped.
It's too bad we don't have an eminent scholar of Shakespeare on here to tell yes. us about Coriolanus. I mean, yes. Unfortunately, it's been so long since I've read Coriolanus that I, other than the bare facts of, you know, him being a Roman general and
Roman general, sort of, yes,
becomes a kind of traitor to Rome, and
so-called traitor to Rome, allegedly,
yeah, but ethereal rumors. But I do think that again, this idea of, you know, being sort of being in a prison of your own making, being in a mental prison, and where your ideas of kind of heroism or the societal ideas of heroism are an ethereal rumor at night, you know, that something sort of vainly whispered about.
Yes, indeed.
And then we get again this sort of return, the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm, your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient, controlling hands. And this spirit for me very much calls up that bit in the Death by Water, this idea of turning the wheel and controlling the ship. And this is a very different image of the heart. You know, we have my friend blood shaking my heart, and then we have the heart responding gaily when invited. You know.
Yes, and there's a kind of, I suppose, to me, this speaks of kind of late Victorian bourgeoisism, because there's this kind of idea that you're rather than being a kind of Odyssean adventurer who could die and face all sorts of horrors on the journey, This is a kind of gay trip to the on a calm sea, you know, on a weekend afternoon, perhaps. You know, the heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. The idea that you're controlled, you're not. This is just an experience that basically has no independence of you. You know, heart would have responded to this. That's just a very personal interpretation, I suppose. But it's just
I think there's also kind of a spiritual explanation here. You know, of course, the idea of the captain. You know, and the boat responding to the hand of the expert. The heart responding to the controlling hand of the expert. And, you know, of course, you know, whether that be, a lover, or whether that be, you know, sort of God or Christ, you know, the heart of a man ready, you know, to be mm-hmm. controlled, to be steered, like a lamb needing a shepherd.
Yes. Quite sad, really. Yeah. Just this kind of, everything is just reduced down to its kind of domestic way.
And of course sad, because that's the last human voice of the poem, I would say.
Yeah.
Because then we, of course, get, I sat upon the shore, fishing with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? The Fish King, again, coming to us in the end. And then the final stanza of the poem is this extraordinary rapid-fire chunks of other things. So, of course, we get the famous nursery rhyme, London Bridge is falling down, which, of course, again, is this sort of a child song about decay and ruination of a civilization.
Yes.
And then we get, you know, right after this, right after the, you know, this sort of... not a nursery rhyme, but a sort of child's play song, we get this image from the Divine Comedy, you know, qua se corsa nel fuoco che li affina,
which is from the Purgatorio, and it means, now I petition you by that kind power, escorting you to the summit of the staircase at the appropriate time, recall my pain. Then he hid himself in the refining fire.
Yes, the refining fire.
Fire. Yes.
Burning, 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 burning.
Yes.
And then we get we get this line, quando fiam uti Celidon. Oh, swallow, swallow.
So this is again from Philomela, according to Eliot, it's from a poem which we don't really know the author of, called Vigil of Venus, and the quoted line translates as, when will I be as the swallow, and it's the last reference in the poem to the myth of Philomela.
And then we get Le Prince d'Aquitaine à la tour abolie.
So this is a translation of a sonnet called El Des de Shadow. And it means simply, the Prince of Aquitaine whose palace spire lies low in the dust. So, you know, again, the idea of this great palace, the spire of the palace lying in the dust. I think it's quite straightforward. I wouldn't add much more to it than that. So then we get on to these fragments I have
Hello.
You're right there, Mr.
No. Yeah, there's a little teacup emergency. Yes, these fragments that I have shored against my ruins, which I think is one of the more important lines in the poem. Because, of course, this is the kind of, this is the image of the person. So we had very early in the poem, you know, only a heap of broken images. And this is literally a person taking that heap of broken images and trying to shore up the collapsing ruins of his civilization, of his spirit, of his soul with these bits and pieces. And I think this is very much, this is very understandable to people today. You know, I mean, I think of, you know, of a man desperately, you know, sort of reading Batman and quoting the Eurythmics and, you know, talking about Andrew Marvell, you know, and wrestling all of these desperate fragments, trying to shore up the broken foundation.
Yes. Did you hear about that Bowie album from 82? You know, all over the place. I mean, you know how it actually says on the channel, Radio 4 for woke people. What it should say is a heap of broken images.
A heap of broken images. Yes.
Yes.
But I mean, I accuse our friend of this. But again, this is the condition we're all living in. This condition. I mean, you know, I see people. I saw people giving sort of harsh criticism to Eliot, but I think that this is an indictment that almost no person alive today can talk their way out of.
No.
can't even drive. There he is.
I don't pretend to know.
Oh, he's just a child of AA. So yes, that line I think is quite important. And then we have, why then I'll fit you, Hieronymus mad again, which is again this very mental reference to another one of the wonderful Jacobian revenge plays called revenge. The Spanish Tragedy, which is particularly nasty.
They all are horrible.
They all are. I mean, it's no Duchess of Malfi. But it's pretty horrible.
I mean, wouldn't it be incredible, again, if there was some sort of scholar who had studied these plays in depth, who could be here and give us extra info on that. But anyway, so Hieronymo, the character, his son Horatio, is murdered by a rival.
Yeah.
And the murder sends Hieronymo mad. And he tries to get revenge, but he's nuts, basically. So he is all over the place. And so that line, I'll fit you.
I'll oblige you.
Yes.
And as the Eliot's note says, Eliot's note's referring to the Spanish Tragedy, but as the context says, there's this great tradition of the kind of mad figure in literature, often driven mad and then sort of redeemed. I'm thinking of sort of Orlando Furioso, and things like that. But and then we get the reiteration of the meaning of the syllables, Dacta, Diadvam, Damyata, you know, to be merciful, to give and to control. And then the final lines of the poem, Shanti, 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 which is a traditional end. Many of the Upanishads end with this evocation, and it's very much akin to sort of, saying Amen.
Yes.
I believe Eliot attempts to define it. It's one of those words that I don't think is particularly translatable.
No.
Yes, Eliot says, Shanti, repeated as here, a formal ending to an Upanishad. The peace which passeth understanding is a feeble translation of the content of the word.
Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of. How on earth do you end it? If you've just written The Wasteland, how on earth do you end it? You know, I mean, I suppose that it's at the same time climactic and anticlimactic, isn't it? You know,
it's sort of telling that it ends with this fit. With this fit of lines, this collage of lines from all over the place, in terms of history and period and culture and author, and then it ends with the formal ending of a Vedic religious text. It's capped off with the kind of the foreign words of a foreign religion, So in the end, I think that it's a line affirming the sort of prophetic quality of the last part, but it's also a line of alienation. In the end, he can do is profess an ending, in a foreign tongue of a foreign god, which is quite strikingly sad in a way.
Asante Habari, which is I know that that's Swahili.
Yeah,
Asante Habari.
He's being troublesome.
Well, I mean, we made it to the end. That's the wasteland. What do we say now after having just presented that?
What do we say? Oh, I know what he's talking about. Okay, sorry. Yes, it's a slightly esoteric David Bowie reference.
Oh, okay.
It's from a song called I think it's from Lodger.
Right.
Yes, off African Night Flight.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, Bowie.
I think it's very interesting. There's a person in the chat whose name is Considering Phlebas. And he says, there are too many languages in that poem. It's almost pretentious. Almost.
Thank you, Phlebas.
Thank you, Phlebas.
Why don't you go back down to the seabed?
Dear me. Maybe we should talk about I'm finding it genuinely difficult to pull myself together now.
I'm distracted by Academic Agent's evocation of African Night Flight because I'm just looking at the lyrics again. African nighttime, one time Mormon, more men fall in hullabaloo men. I slide to the nearest bar, undermine chairman, I went too far. Bent on a windfall, rent a Sony. It's difficult to read it in the cadence that Bowie does, but yes, this line, his burning eye will see me through. One of these days, got to get a word through. One of these days, Asante Habari, Habari, Habari. There's something almost Eliot-like in that as well. Thank you, Academic Agent. Very cool.
Did Bowie have much to say on T.S. Eliot ever?
I don't know. I'm sure Bowie was familiar with Eliot. I would have to think about that. I don't know. I can't think of any specific Eliot references. Although the idea of sort of inhabiting various characters to kind of tell these fragmentary tales. We're being directed to. So if anyone has any kind of questions or comments about the wasteland, yeah. I mean, I think in summary, this poem is it's always held a great fascination for me, and it's I would say probably one of Eliot's most famous works, but I don't think that it's his masterpiece. I think his masterpiece lies in the Four Quartets for me. This is very much as you said when we were talking this morning. This is the work of a younger man.
Of a young, maddened, annoyed, frenzied, learned young man who's basically screaming at the condition of the modern world. This is not to try and downplay it as an achievement in any way.
No, I mean, of course, it's a monumentally great poem, and of course, certainly one of the monuments of 20th century poetry. Yes. But yes, I mean, it is very much a work of its time and place, and as all great works are.
Yes.
It's a work of its time and place, but of course, it still holds extraordinary relevance to us. Well, one thing before we move on, I just thought it was interesting. This is it's actually from a paper written about the by Dr. Radhakrishnan about the Hindu influences in the wasteland. Dr. Radhakrishnan records how T.S. Eliot, when asked about the future of our civilization, said, "Internecine fighting, people killing one another in the streets. Civilization to him appeared a crumbling edifice destined to perish in the flames of war." And it's very hard to look around and disagree with that assessment, from over 100 years ago.
I mean, I only wish it did crumble in war.
Well, again, I think so many people do long for the purifying fire, long for the deluge.
Yes.
All right. So, shall we do the
super chats?
The super chat. Do you want to?
I take great pleasure in this. So,
okay.
We begin with James Carter for £2. Says £2 for Mr. D. He looks good as L'Incroyable Hulk. I was gonna ask you about your avatar for today. Was there any particular reason you chose it? And I agree with him. It does look quite Hulk-like with the purple and the green.
Pick one.
We have RC. W, £5, said, "This is a drink for your friends, AA." So does he mean us or AA's IRL friends?
I don't know. I didn't think AA had any.
Does he have any? Anyway, we're only joking. James Carter, £2 for Marvel. Thank you. I'm very keen on the Marvel stream. That it's still get there in the end. It's going to become the highest earning stream. So we have Machiavellius Sucks to Go for $4.99 USD. Says, "You should see Ringo live on. I saw her standing there." You should see Ringo live on. I saw her standing there.
Okay.
Is that a song by
Ringo? Of course it's a song. It's the bloody Beatles.
I don't know anything about this boomer culture. Anyway, could we scroll down, please?
You call yourself a man of letters. Yeah. And I saw her standing there. Yeah. Okay. Scrolling up.
Is that all? Do we have more?
Is that it? Is that all we get?
But there's more. There's more super chats. I saw them. There's lots more.
Yeah, I saw them as well. Come on.
Put them back.
Where are they?
We need to do the super chat.
There's at least one. There's at least one in entropy from Yiz.
Yes. Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe he's checking the entropy.
No. Is he?
Oh.
No.
Yeah, okay. Yiz the Eunuch for USD $3 says, "John D is why men of taste follow this channel. Panama hat is all right too."
Yay!
There you go. I'll take that. That's fine. I agree. I'll go with that. Right. What else do we have here?
These antics are a delight. Yeah. I saw another from Machiavelli Sucks to Go.
Yes.
I saw the word Russia. I don't know if we.
Yeah, I don't know. If it's a rank punditry.
Rank punditry.
Oh, academic agent says I saw. Oh, there we go. I saw her standing there. Was played at my first wedding. Don't marry the girl you fall in love with when you were 17. Dear me.
Oh, dear. I'm going to play a bit of I Saw Her Standing There.
Okay.
Let's see. Do you think playing the Beatles will get...
I don't know.
I'm not going to do it.
There's a lot of great information and history in this book, and even a mystery trick that you can learn at the end. So take it from me, Kenneth Michael Benbow Blake. This is a great book to read, so pick it up at your local library now.
Well, thank you, Kenneth Michael Benbow Blake.
Was that you as a child?
No, it wasn't me as a child. though my name is about as long as that. So,
lol.
Anyway, thank you,
Mystery Piccadilly. probably shouldn't say that. Yes. So, well, it was wonderful. I think discussing the Wasteland. I hope people enjoyed it as much as we did. I mean, we certainly had long conversations about this poem and other Eliot poems in private. So,
I'd like to do the rest of the super chats, but if not, I just want to bring up something sort of humorous to end this on.
I thought that was all.
No, there were more. There we go. The Academic Agent Channel does not endorse the language or comments of Mr. D. We condemn all racism. Well, there you go.
Okay.
So are we going to get to the super chats or? I mean, if not, I have something I want to talk about. Quickly,
I hope.
Well, yes, because so just a humorous thing to end on. H.P. Lovecraft, who I'm sure many in the chat will know.
It's not about his cat, is it?
No, it's not about his cat. He took rather a dislike to The Wasteland. And he wrote a parody of The Wasteland called The Waste Paper. I just wanted to end on the last few lines from it. It is genuinely quite funny, even if I disagree with the will that comes from behind it. He says things like Shanty House was the name of a novel by I forget whom, published serially in the All Story Weekly before it was weekly, and ends on Shanty, farewell, Shanty, nobody home in the shanty. I don't know. I found it funny.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Owen Kapler, for US $5, says, marry the girl you fell in love with when you were 17 if you are properly disposed and have a right understanding of the permanence of married life. Well, Owen Kapler, I'm afraid I missed that. I missed out on that girl when I was 17. But I suppose that's certainly good advice for some people, you know. Maybe not our beloved academic.
No.
I'd feel very bad because if people sent super chats and we haven't gone over them. That's very.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to do, AA? There's people have paid you, not us, you money, and you're not letting us read their super chats.
There are no more super chats. What about that one about Russia? I saw the word Russia.
It was one. Yeah.
From a different? That may be from a different stream.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. It may list them all. Yeah.
Well, I'm getting married young, so sucks to you, AA. There you go.
All right, folks. Well, thank you very much for joining us for this. This explication of The Wasteland. I certainly hope that we have another chance to do poetry, either with me or with you, at least with you.
Yeah, certainly.
And
maybe one day my own poems will be discussed. But no, that's probably
exactly. Yes, we could do a hat poetry.
I hate people reading my work in front of me. The last time somebody tried to do that, I took the book out of their hands and sat on it. So,
yeah. Well, there you go. Well, I understand as a creator myself. I have none of my own creation anywhere near me. So, all right. Well, as far as the Deepest lore, I don't know what's coming up for people next week. It may be the return of the mythical pharaoh. The prodigal pharaoh returns.
I thought you were going to say Batman. Didn't AA have to like cancel the Batman month? Didn't he say that he gave up on it? Or?
Well, he had one stream and he didn't do it for some reason. He became wounded in the loins like the Fisher King.
Oh no!
He lost his masculine mojo and he can't do the deepest lore anymore. So. But hopefully he'll be back, and possibly the return of Pharaoh next week. I'm not sure what the schedule has in store, but I know that's coming, and I certainly look forward to it. I miss
our friend Pharaoh.
So look forward to that. Join us on the AA channel tomorrow night for the hit weekly show, Unpopular Opinions.
Oh yes.
And then on Wednesday is the cigar stream. Are you going to be on that again? Because I notice it's part two of.
I can be. If I didn't dishonor myself too much on the last one, I'm sure I'll be back on.
And don't forget to catch Academic Agent on Cotto Gottfried tonight at some time. No, Wednesday is Dutton and Mike from Imperium. Okay, well, okay, that's good.
Look at all his new friends.
he's
a big shot now. He's got a book out. He's not gonna talk to us anymore. Likes of us. Yeah.
Oh, if he only knew how much I'm slumming it even talking to him.
Oh,
all right. all right, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Have a wonderful day and goodbye. And most importantly.
Shanti.
Shanti.